The Comics in the Golden Age podcast is a proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. For more information, visit comicspodcasts.com.
It was 1938. While war clouds loom throughout Asia, German aggression builds in Europe. Americans seek comfort and distraction. It was to become the Golden Age of the American comic book.
Hello and welcome to Comics in the Golden Age. This is Mike Lane, and I am joined by a very special guest tonight, the podcrasher, the famous podcrasher, Tim Price. Thank you, Tim, for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Michael. How are you doing today?
I am doing very well. How about you, sir?
I am doing fine. Busy. It's busy work being a podcrasher, I'll tell you that.
You do it well. You're a very busy man, I know.
Oh, thank you. I try to spread lots of joy, or I don't know, mayhem, I guess it depends on point of view.
We were talking before we went on, and Tim is unique because he is one, other than the Darren Aru Sutherland of the Rad Adventures Network and several shows, he is the only other person I have podcasted with as a guest who I have met in real life before podcasting with him.
And I'm really honored to hear that.
I was lucky enough to meet Tim in real life at Baltimore Comic Con, I guess a little over a year ago, was it?
Yeah, that was in October of 2018. Yeah, sounds right. That was so much fun of a convention. I had, and it was so great to meet you and hang out with you as well.
You too. I had a great time.
Oh, yeah.
So it was now I go there every year. It's my favorite convention because I don't live too far from Baltimore. But it was that year that a lot of podcasters had kind of met up. And I did get to have lunch with you one day, and I just had a great time talking comics with you. It was a lot of fun.
Absolutely. Well, I think we've had, and what's been great is that we'd already kind of, we connected more or less over Twitter already.
True.
And although I don't really think I'm still a podcaster, I guess I kind of am now, but I'm a permanent, semi-permanent co-host now. I guess that kind of makes me a podcaster now.
I think you've got enough credentials now that you qualify.
But what was really just fun was just talking with you and connecting face to face there. But then I think we also really connected even more so. And I apologize for it when I was posting my read through on Usagi Yojimbo.
Oh, yes.
And I was just seeing I was trying not to be too spoilery, but there were some things that were like, oh, this is so awesome. And I was just posting them out there. And you were like texting me back like, that's fantastic. Why have I never read this yet? I'm like, I know, because I hadn't read it before either.
I should thank you, actually, because that's a series that I have had so many people recommend to me over so many years. Mm-hmm. And I've always thought, and one of the reasons I didn't read it was I actually thought I'd really like it. But I'm someone that if I get into something, I kind of go overboard and dive into it, and it kind of pushes things aside. I don't do anything kind of halfway or dabble. If I get into something and I like it, it's going to become like my focus for a while. And I thought, geez, if I start reading that, that's going to be a whole nother thing. But it had been slowly kind of chipping away in my mind over years. And when you started posting about a lot, I was like, you know what? I'm finally going to take the leap. And I'll be damned, it was just like I thought. I'm like buying the Omnibuy, and I'm just the large saga collections and diving through it. And it became that meeting the creator this year at Baltimore, he became my top priority of all the people. And there was a huge number of amazing, you know, I met Walter Louise Simonson were there. And Steranko was there, but he had become my top priority because I'm so in love with that comic. And yeah, I have to thank you for finally being the one to push me over the edge and start reading it.
Well, I feel like I'm just paying that forward. I'll also give props to Pat Sampson of the Long Box Crusade, because it was on their 12 Days of Christmas podcasts where he suggested Usagi Yojimbo, and I had bought the collection on a Comixology sale. So it's like, okay, I really do need to read this. So I had a nice, you know, family trip coming up, and it's like, okay, this would be a good time to read it. I can just burn through it when we're not doing anything. And darned if I didn't just fall in love with it right away. So, and it made it also like sharing my journey, since it was already on my tablet for Comixology, made it really easy as I went along, almost too easy. So I'm paying it forward from Pat, and then passing it along to you. It's just how our fandoms just keep on going and going. So, yeah, it's been a great joy to do that.
And, you know, now that you mention it, I was thinking about Twitter because we do interact a decent amount on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And we're part of kind of the similar circle of a comics community. And, you know, Twitter can be a cesspool at times, you know, obviously, if you're not careful. But I think we're both lucky in that we're surrounded by a pretty positive comics community, kind of have our own little kind of chunk of Twitter carved out. And I've been exposed to so much stuff I wasn't before. I've gotten to know so many other fans through it and become, you know, what I consider. I mean, we talk mostly online. We live all over the country, but I've gotten to meet some people I've grown to consider really good friends, and being able to share the fandom with them has been a really wonderful experience on there. I've been really happy. And you introducing me to Usagi is a perfect example of that.
Oh yeah, you're quite welcome. And I felt the same way myself. It's that Twitter is just where my friends are. It's crazy. You know, I've only started listening to podcasts 3 years ago. I didn't even listen to podcasts at all, let alone thinking that there might be podcasts on topics that I would be interested in. I just didn't even think about it. And trying the very first one, the JLI Wahaha podcast was the first one. And that just hooked me. And now it's turned into this whole thing. And yeah, it's like Twitter is where my friends are. I go just to chat with and see what you guys are doing and see the great posts, and especially the ones that you have out there on a regular basis are always so much fun.
Oh, thank
you. Like, which leads us even to like what we're talking about today. It's like, I would not have discovered this character if not for your posts about them.
Yeah, I should mention, because it hasn't come up yet, that we are going to be talking about the Golden Age superhero Miss Victory, the first patriotic superheroine. But before we get into that, though, I want to get a little bit more into Tim's story here. I want to ask Tim, can you share with us your comics origin story? How did you get into comic books?
I can share that. I don't know if you'll be thanking me afterwards, but I can share it with you. I basically always enjoyed the superheroes. I mean, as early as I can remember, I was watching cartoons on TV of reruns for the Spider-Man TV show from 67, or even like the old Batman and Superman cartoons from the Filmation, and even like the Marvel superheroes cartoon that had like Captain America, the Hulk, and were basically like recreations of the comic books. I remember those very young, and going straight into seeing the Super Friends when it first aired. So I was hooked on superheroes from the very beginning. And so occasionally my folks would let us have some comic books. And so those were great fun. You know, that was a good, I enjoyed them quite a bit. But what really got me hooked and kind of set my path was when I was in second or third grade. So I was maybe, you know, 7, 8 years old. We had just moved to a new neighborhood. We traveled around a lot because my father was a minister. We actually did some different new churches where we were going to. And we had a new neighbor, and he asked my folks if we would be interested in taking some old comic books. And my folks kind of naively said yes, because there are three of us kids. So, you know, free reading material is always still a good thing. What it turned out was that he gave us a few thousand comic books.
Wow.
Because what he had done, and you might know about this, is that he had lived close enough to the local dime store where they were selling comic books on the racks there. And the dime store would then tear off the top third of the cover to send back for a refund. Stores could do that back in the day. So they would send out the top third of the cover back to the publisher to get a refund, but then they'd throw the comic book into the dumpster. So he was basically dumpster diving all these books out of for years. Wow. And he just had thousands of them. So our basement was just overrun with stacks of comic books that were in poor to pathetic condition, but you still could read them. And I just went crazy and was spent like my whole summer down in the basement reading all the comic books I could go through and trying not to read too many twice, but it was hard to keep track.
That sounds glorious.
Oh, it was amazing because it was comics from like the 60s. Most of them were from the 60s. So there were tons of Archie and some Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse, even other and plenty of other, you know, cartoons and newspaper
like Dell Comics characters and stuff.
Lots of and there were some Dell Comics, and I remember very distinctly finding even like one Magnus Robot Fighter and one Turok, Son of Stone. But you'd also have a few Tarzan mixed in there, or Korak, Son of Tarzan, and all these other things in there. There was like almost no superhero comic books, though. So obviously those were selling better because there weren't any of those for him to pick up. But the humor comic books and even some of the lesser-known adventure comic books, you could find plenty of those. So I read a lot of Archie also. Just in a nutshell, there was a lot of Archie. But obviously, like by the time I was going through there and my folks having to just like pry me away from the comic books saying, go outside, it was pretty much should have been a clue where my heart would be going into the future. But then a few years later, I started like making my own money, from like mowing lawns and stuff like that. And then the opportunity was like, hey, there's new comics on the stands. I mean, I'd had years of reading comic books that I hadn't gotten tired of. So it was kind of hard to switch gears and go like, I should get new comics. Really? But, you know, I started getting into that, too.
I have to ask you, when you got into that, too. Mm-hmm. Were you sticking to the types of comics you like, Archie and stuff, or did you expand out into other things like superhero comics and things, or did that come later?
Right. I was mostly getting into superhero comics because that was still like the occasional treat was my folks getting us like a Treasury sized edition of Spider-Man, or like that Treasury of the Fantastic Four that included the Galactus trilogy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Things like that. I like the Treasury that had the Sinister Six, that Treasury. But also like Christmas with the Superheroes from DC Comics and like a Justice League of America Treasury. So there was all sorts of things like that as well. And occasionally for road trips, you know how you could get those 3-packs from selection from the toy store.
Mm-hmm.
You'd get some of those and you'd have some comic books that way too. So I was definitely also seeing here and there some of the more modern superhero stories along the way. Well, and actually just classics, you know, when you get to the Treasuries, they're like the 60s, you know, so they're classics there too. But I was definitely, that was my love with superheroes. And also my folks did get us like 2 hardback books once upon a time. I still have one of them. It was Batman from the 30s to the 70s.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And we also got the matching Superman one. If my family still has it, then my brother would have the Superman one. I still have the Batman one, but unfortunately it's in bad shape. And the original cover, the original paperback cover that wrapped around it, that one long since fell apart.
That's called being well-loved.
Yes, that's exactly what happened to it. Because I would read that thing until like 3 in the morning sometimes. And my dad would come in, turn out the light. So it was pretty obvious what I was going for. But yeah, so when I was buying comics, I was definitely getting into the superheroes. And it's like, oh man, like, I was one of the first things I even was really getting into regularly was like Batman and the Outsiders. That just was starting to come out when I started buying comics off the stands. And then another treat was being in, you know, band in school is that there's always a fundraiser going on. And so one of the fundraisers was magazine subscriptions. And this program actually included Marvel Comics as options for the subscriptions.
Oh, that's neat. I don't remember anything like that when I was going on.
Yeah, it was very unusual. You don't see that. I don't think I've ever seen it in any of them since. But as a result, my folks agreed to get us 2 subscriptions. And we got Amazing Spider-Man and The Avengers. And this was back in 1980, something like that. I still buy Avengers and Amazing Spider-Man monthly to the day. That's a long time.
Now, was that around issue? Would that be like in the 190 range or 200s around Avengers?
Yes, it was the early, it was like 203 or 205.
Okay, and that, I guess with Spider-Man, that's pre-Roger Stern, right? That's a few years before.
It was pre-Roger Stern. It was still, I believe Denny O'Neill was writing it then. It was just a couple years before that. I know the exact issue that I started with. I don't know if it's number offhand, but it was a multi-parter of Spider-Man and the Frightful Four, where Namor was a guest star.
Oh,
and we have like both of them on the cover being attacked by the Frightful Four is the first issue.
I got to look that up after we get off because I cannot picture that cover, but it sounds cool.
Oh, it's quite cool. And so that was like my first one. And getting Spider-Man monthly in the mail was just fantastic. And I kept that subscription going for a little while, and that even got into John Romita Jr.'s era of drawing the book.
Mm-hmm.
So I always have a love for that series as a result. I can't
Was that your favorite?
I can't quit either of those series. I just can't quit either of those series now. No matter what changes happen creatively, I'll still give them a chance because I want to see, because something, if, even if I don't like what's going on right now, I'll like it. I might like it in a couple months. Yeah, Spider-Man's my favorite character. There's no two ways about it. Spider-Man always, from the very first cartoon and everything about it, he was my favorite character all the way, and I'm not giving up my Spider-Man.
I just to interrupt you for a second, I love Spider-Man. He's not my top list, but I like him. But I have always said I firmly believe he has the best origin story of any superhero. He may not personally mm-hmm. be my favorite character, but I absolutely think he has far and away the best origin story.
Oh, I definitely agree with that. With his personality and his powers are that perfect thing of, like, he's not overwhelming like Superman. He's smart and agile like Batman, and just the fact that he's just a nerd. At his heart, he's a nerd, and you know, I can't help but sympathize with that, and that I identified with that from day one. So that told me a lot about myself too.
And also, he does, especially if you consider the year he was created. He has one of the greatest costumes ever designed, generally. Absolutely. But if you consider that was costume was designed in, was it 1961? Am I remembering that right?
1962? That is 62.
Okay. It's amazing to me that, because it's such a unique costume in comparison to everything. I mean, not that superheroes were huge yet. I mean, they'd been back for a few years. But mm-hmm. if you look at, you know, DC, it had Flash, Green Lantern, you know, right. They brought the Justice League back. You had the Fantastic Four. In that context, Spider-Man's costume is just amazing. The design mm-hmm. is so unique, but it's also timeless. I mean, they've never, other than a few tweaks in some of the movie costumes, mm-hmm. you know, while they've tweaked, you know, Iron Man's changed a million times. They've even altered and evolved Superman and Batman and Captain America. And occasionally Spider-Man will go to temporary costume change, but it always comes right. back to that original design because it's just perfect.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say it's iconic. That
definitely.
That the full face mask where you can't see any of his features at all, and the big eyes that, you know, you just can't see anything out of it, makes him the mystery of him. there really had been no hero that was like that, or, you know, who's has lasted as long as that before Spider-Man came along. Mm-hmm. If there are others who attempted to do that, it's like they didn't last as long as Spider-Man did.
Yeah. So if you got these subscriptions, did you stick with comics? Have you always collected comics? Did you get out of it for a while and come back?
That's a good question. I know I've heard other people who have, but really I haven't gotten out of it ever since then. I've been able to stick with it. I've had a few. In fact, there's a lot of things where comics was important to my life. I mean, the sad truth is that we had that, in addition to movings, that meant that we moved again after I got that huge, after we got that huge section of free comic books. I couldn't take them all, so plenty of them had to be left behind.
No.
And in later moves, like, there was also a terrible flood in one city that I lived in, and so all the comic books that were in the basement, which was most of them, they're a loss. The set of superhero comic books that I kept upstairs was really all that I salvaged from that period. So there's even lots of all the old Treasury editions, they're also lost as well, which is so disheartening when I see them today and go, oh, I remember that one. but then also around that same period is, you know, just spoilers, don't let it get you down. My dad passed away in 1983 from cancer. So yeah. We had to move again to be from Illinois to Virginia to be closer to where my mother's family was, to kind of help have some support. And so the comics, a lot of the comics couldn't come with me. They just couldn't. There was no way for it to really work. But as a result, what happened there was that I was continuing to just earn for myself and buy my own comic books. And we got into things like, I was hitting all the drugstores. And then there was my mother, who really was good at shopping, liked to go shopping. So we'd hit the malls. Walden Books was there, and Walden Books was carrying comic books back then.
I bought many a comic book at Walden Books over the years back then.
Oh, man. I was reminded of that recently, and it's like, oh, man, Walden Books was just the paradise for those of us who had no comic book shop to really go to. got us. They were the supplier, so it was perfect.
They were a dealer.
Indeed. But then that led to when I went to college, I did start going to a comic book shop and was able to get books mailed to me from the comic book shop then. And over the years, I've been able to follow comic book shops and get my own things that way. But in recent years, it's been harder for me to get to a shop. But I have a friend from college who opened his own shop. So the last several years, I get things mailed to me from him.
And where is he located? Where's his shop?
He's in Williamsburg, Virginia.
He has it's not too far then.
No, it's the Comic Cubicle in Williamsburg, Virginia. And I've known him ever since he was like just 1 year ahead of me in college. And it's great, great store. I love supporting it. If you ever do find yourselves there, dear listeners, he has a life-size statue of the Silver Surfer in the shop. It is worth going just to see that. And also to see the outfit that he's chosen for the Silver Surfer that month.
So he dresses him up regularly?
Yeah, Hawaiian shirts are a frequent accessory for the Silver Surfer. So yeah, I've been collecting. So basically, the short answer is that no, I never stopped really collecting comic books. How many comic books I've collected changes over the years. So I've had some years where it's been a whole lot per month, like 50 a month or more. But I'm much more saner numbers now.
Well, unfortunately, I mean, the cost nowadays just makes it so hard to collect titles. I would love, I mean, a few years ago, I got to the point where my monthly costs were ridiculous. And my wife, fortunately for our both of us, stepped in and was like, this is just too much for a month. And I greatly cut back. And it was painful at the time. Mm-hmm. But in retrospect, I'm like, thank God, because that was just way too much money going on a monthly basis to comic books. If I won the lottery tomorrow, I'd be buying, you know, ridiculous amount every month, but it's just realistic.
Yeah, I do. I am also torn. I do appreciate the permanence of having the physical comics, but my goodness, it is so much easier to on the storage needs to just go digital. So I really do like the digital options nowadays. And I'm reading so many comics, older comics on the digital platforms now.
I
haven't had a chance to read before. I really love it.
I was actually going to ask you if you had switched fully to digital, because I see on, you know, on Twitter, a lot of your updates of what you're reading are on Marvel Unlimited or other digital sources. So I wasn't sure if you were still even buying physical copies at this point, or if you just made that leap.
Well, I do buy my Avengers and Spider-Man as physical copies. And that's a big part of, like, I want supporting my friend who has a shop too. I do want to continue doing that, so I feel good about that. But yeah, I have but between, you know, reading the analog versions of the comics, I do spend a lot of time on Marvel Unlimited. I've been more on a DCU app kick recently. There's been some fun things going on over there. I really want to start a read of All-Star comics from the 70s. I've really wanted to read more on especially Power Girl and Huntress.
Oh, so you're talking back in the Joe Staton, era. I love that. That's some good stuff. Wally Wood,
Yeah, I know about it and I haven't read it. So that's like the next kind of big reading project I want to start on with the DCU app.
That's a good project. I was, when that app first came out, I was really disappointed in the amount of comic content they had. But over the last year, they have added a tremendous amount more, and I've been much happier with what I see when I go on it.
Absolutely. I mean, I felt the same way. I love the DCU, the Marvel Unlimited app. I love that right off the bat because of just all the comics that were available. I was not sure about the DCU app, even though they had the videos, the TV shows. I was like, but when the Doom Patrol TV show actually came out and I started just getting little tidbits about it and of it on Twitter, I just couldn't take it anymore, and I had to get it. I had to get it just for the Doom Patrol show. It's a fantastic show. And it's really sad that it was like, oh yeah, I just couldn't take it. It was terrible. I was feeling it. I was feeling like I'm missing it. I must fix this. But then within like 2 months of me signing up for it, that's when they opened up the floodgates for their digital comics on the DCU app. So it was, I have not regretted getting it since then. So it was very lucky. But also I did have this problem is that when I first got the Marvel Unlimited app, I was saying to myself, my joke to my wife was that, oh, if DC ever offers something like this, I'm just going to have to quit work. And now DC called my bluff. So it's a bit of a problem. But is there anything you like to read on the digital specifically?
Well, I am also on the Marvel Unlimited and the DC Universe app. And I also will sometimes buy stuff on Comicology. I generally only buy with sales, though.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to buy only when, you know, there's some really good deals out there, because there's so much available if you just do a subscription that I just can't really be spending the money that I'd like to support more if I could, but I tend to wait for the deals. I also, for obvious reasons, spend a good amount of time on the Digital Comic Museum or Comic Book Plus, because they have so much public domain, golden age and sometimes silver age material. So I appreciate those sites. I was curious, actually, bringing those up. When you read like Miss Victory, or I think you posted about Pat Patriot at one point, which of those sites are you getting that from? Which one do you go to?
Yeah, I actually asked your advice on where to start with this. So I was, and you pointed me to, oh, phooey, I forget his name. You said it just a second ago.
It was either the Digital Comics Museum or a Comic Book Plus are the two big ones for that.
You pointed me to the Digital Comics Museum, and that's where I was able to find the Miss Victory, the issues that had Miss Victory in them. So that's what I've been using.
Yeah. I kind of go back. For a long time, I was just Digital Comics Museum, but I've kind of switched over recently to Comic Book Plus more. I still do both, but those I, you know, not just for the podcast, but just to go back and read, particularly when it comes to Plastic Man comics and the Marvel family from the 40s. I've read a lot of theirs.
Oh, nice.
Unfortunately, for years, it was considered that the Marvel family comics in the 40s were all public domain. A few months ago, for some reason, Warner Brothers cracked down, and I'm an attorney, but I don't know copyright law that well. And I don't know where it came from. But for some reason, a select number, not everything, you can still find Captain Marvel and Captain Marvel Jr. issues on those websites in the public domain. But for some reason, a big chunk of all of them, particularly Mary Marvel, for some reason, were removed because WB delivered copyright letters saying, you know, you can't be in. The websites are very careful what they post, and they agree they thought they had a good copyright claim. I've never gotten a story of exactly how that happened, because, like I said, they've been available on there for like at least 10 years or so that I've been going. So that kind of cut into the Marvel family issues to a large degree. But like I said, some are still there. Gotcha. And, you know, a lot of the Freedom Fighters characters that DC uses, a lot of their Golden Age stuff is available, a lot of other titles. So anyone listening, if you've never checked out Digital Comics Museum or Comic Book Plus, it's just a gold mine of Golden Age material. I would highly recommend checking it out. It's all free. It's completely legal. I'm not someone that would ever download stuff illegally. I don't like the idea of it. I think particularly comics. Comics struggle enough, and far too much stuff is downloaded illegally, and I do think it hurts the industry. But in this particular case, it's all public domain, so it's totally free. It's not stuff that companies are out there publishing or reprinting, so you're not taking away business from anyone. But both websites are just a treasure.
Now that's excellent.
So, Tim, real quick before we turn to Miss Victory, you had talked about kind of comics and losing comics. I just wanted to tell you one little story. Other people listening have probably heard it. But my dad, he's 78 now. He was born in 1941. And when he was a kid, he collected comics. You know, he became a big comic fan. And he was very lucky because his uncle worked for a printer, and they printed comic books. So every month or so, he would drop a stack of comics for free to my dad.
Oh, wow.
And he got literally in his closet. He would have boxes and stacks of comics. He had hundreds of them. It was late 40s, early 50s. So some like Timely's superheroes had moved on at that point. But he did have, you know, the Marvel family. That was his favorite superhero comic. He had a lot of Dell. He had a lot of Westerns. He had a lot of crime comics. It's one of those things, I'll show him pictures of stuff and he'll be like, no, I don't remember that. Oh, yeah, I definitely had that. Mm-hmm. But he went off to college and he left him at home. And he came back from college one day and asked his mom, what happened to all those comics? And she told him that she threw them all out. And that is always, poor guy, he feels guilty. Yeah. It's not his fault. But it's always haunted me because I just think of what a gold mine he had of late 40s, early 50s comic books that if he had been able to, and he would have saved them. He loved them. He was, you know, he's not as nerdy guy like I am, but he definitely would have helped those comics. And oh my God, so many Marvel family, so many others, just would have been glorious. So every time, you know, he tells me that story, I die a little inside.
Oh, can I share one more quick little story then in the same vein?
Sure.
Is that, but of course we've all, I'm sure the listeners here are all used to and have heard that story of somewhere of the person whose folks got rid of your comics when they were away. Even my mom has told me that she had her own comics when she was a kid. But I think they were mostly humor comics, but she loved them. And one day her dad just decided to burn them because they were taking up space.
Why did he burn them though? Was it part of that whole 50s crackdown thing on comics?
I'm not sure. She was just more ticked off than anything else. So I try not to push too hard on that. It's a sore subject that even today, that was a long time ago. But yeah, so it's one of those things that I also take some heart that it's perhaps in our blood, you know.
Tell your mom I feel for her. That's just,
I will
burning
that.
Too is especially like twisting the knife a little
it
bit.
Is. It is like at least they're somewhere, but it's like
yeah, no. I know. You could hope that if they're just left on the curb, maybe someone like your family garbage dog or that guy who gave them, you picked them out of the garbage. But if they're burned, mm-hmm. they just went off into the mist, which is just sad.
Absolutely.
So we should turn to the actual comic we are here to talk about, which is Miss Victory. So I'm just going to discuss Miss Victory's history a little bit. She was created by artist Charles Quinlan and an unknown writer, unfortunately. Her real name is Joanne Wayne. She was a stenographer living in Washington, D.C., who became frustrated by the corruption in government and first put on her costume to fight crooked politicians. Of course, World War II soon broke out, and she decided to help in the war effort by fighting America's enemies. She became the first patriotic superheroine in comics. At first, they didn't give her an origin that showed any special training or gaining superpowers or anything like that. But in her actual story, she seemed to actually have them. She seemed to be super strong and vulnerable. She was able to survive explosions and knock down walls, etc. So she was definitely a superhero, even if they never quite explained the circumstances in the actual comics. Now, much later on, this character, although she fell into limbo in the mid-40s, she got revived by AC Comics in 1984 in their Femme Force book. In their comics, she did get a more elaborate origin. She was Dr. Joanne Wayne, a research scientist who develops a secret formula, V-47. This was originally intended to give super strength and stamina to Allied soldiers, but only ended up working on her. In this storyline, she stopped aging, which meant that she was still young in the present day in these comics in the 80s. Now, in her history, she first appeared in Captain Fearless Comics No. 1, which was cover dated August 1941. She appeared in the second issue of that title and then moved over to Captain Arrow Comics. Now, Captain Arrow had a really weird numbering system because it was one company published it, then it got picked up by another company, and they changed the numbering halfway through. So it ran, as far as her appearances, from December 1941 to August 1946. It was only 14 issues during that time, but renumbering occurred throughout, so it's a little confusing if you ever look up the history of that title. She also appeared in a very unusual one-shot, Miss Victory No. 3, that came out in 1944. Numbering in the Golden Age could be pretty screwed up, and then well through the Silver Age, because they didn't want to have to pay, postal costs for new titles, so they would just move the numbering around between different titles. That Miss Victory No. 3 continued the numbering from another title, Corporal Rusty Dugan Comics No. 2, and then continued on in the renamed Mr. Miracle Comics No. 4. Now, she is on the cover of this book, but the cover really looks more like an interior splash page than it does an actual traditional cover. And this issue contains only reprinted stories from other older comics and does not actually contain a Miss Victory story, even though she is on the cover and she is the title character. So I've never gotten a really good explanation on what's going on with that comic, but it is technically the only Miss Victory comic from the Golden Age. Now, as I said, she was created by Charles Quinlan and an unknown writer. Quinlan was very active in comics in the 40s and 50s and worked for a number of studios and companies. He co-created Kitten, who was a sidekick for the Golden Age hero Catman, which some of you may be familiar with. Otherwise, his credits included titles like Hopalong Cassidy for Fawcett Comics, Real Life Comics and Mass Rider for Better Publications, and Crash Barker for Fiction House. Unfortunately, very little seems to be known about Mr. Quinlan after he left comics. So with that, I'm going to turn things over to Tim, and we are going to discuss the story that he is covering.
Okay, so I was going to cover Miss Victory's story that appears in Captain Arrow No. 7. And for those of you listening, the Arrow is not A-R-R-O-W. It is A-E-R-O, like something that's flying. So that Captain Arrow Comics. So that's I know that Arrow is very much a TV star right now, too. So I want to make sure we get that straight.
No, I should have pointed that out. Thank you.
So in this story, let me give my synopsis here. In the office of the Secretary of Commerce, Joan Wayne is checking on employees of a defense plant and recognizes names from her hometown. She goes to check on Mr. and Mrs. Duckett, but doesn't recognize the man who answers the door, who drags her inside. The man is part of a gang of Nazi spies intent on blowing up the plant. The gang goes to raid the Commerce Secretary's office for their records. Meanwhile, Joan and Mrs. Duckett knock out the fake Mr. Duckett, and Joan races to the office as Miss Victory. She sets off the burglar alarm to call the police and takes out the spies using a mop. That's one way to clean up this town. The cops arrive, and Miss Victory makes a graceful exit sliding down the banister. The next morning, Joan's boss is impressed, reading the story of Miss Victory's victory in the paper, while Joan says she'll have to read it, as she's so different from me. And that's the story from Captain Arrow number 7.
If I could jump in before I let you elaborate any thoughts on the issue. Mm-hmm. One thing that I was a bit jealous with your story is it had an awesome splash page. Because not only is she kicking the butt of three guys at once, tossing them, beating them, tossing them down the stairs, but that middle guy.
Oh, yeah.
That has to be painful because the two other guys are basically being tossed head first down the stairs. But that mm-hmm. middle guy, he has his legs open. He's going down facing forward. And the part of him that's hitting the steps potentially is excruciatingly painful.
Yes.
So when I saw that, I was like, that's both painful to look at and kind of badass for Miss Victory at the same time. So I really love that splash page.
Yeah, this story was the first one that was either the first or second one that I read when I started looking for her stories. And just reading this one sold me on her concept just right away. But yeah, that splash page is just fantastic. And like the fact that you have like a literal splashing on the page of the mop and the mop bucket that's spilling down. But yeah, the three goons are just priceless, how they're being waylaid. And as you said, the guy in the middle, also the look on his face of like is not a happy look.
Yeah, I would definitely rather be one of the other two guys who's heading down mm-hmm. face first.
Ostensibly, face first is much more dangerous, but it doesn't look worse in this image, that's for sure. Yeah,
not in this particular one.
Yeah. Yes, so. I really enjoyed this story a whole lot. It gives us everything we need to know about Miss Victory. She's got a whole Diana Prince vibe going on when she's Joan Wayne. You know, she's wearing glasses all the time. She's got her hair pulled back. She's dressed more or less conservatively. So there's a lot of themes that you can see borrowed from that kind of story. Not that even that was invented in the Wonder Woman stories either. I mean, this is you can see the same sort of parallels on the Clark Kent versus Superman look too. So it just works, and it's the kind of concept that they're gonna do here. But there's definitely some aping of Wonder Woman tropes in here, but without the bondage. Thank goodness for that.
Yeah, I notice in these stories they really play up the Washington D.C. setting. Mm-hmm. You are like they make a point to show the Capitol behind it. They make a point to show that it is taking place in Washington D.C., which mm-hmm. you know a lot of Golden Age comics take place in nondescript, you know, made up cities, you know, Gotham or Metropolis and such. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of interesting. It was a more modern day approach to make it so clearly set in Washington, D.C. And I like that setting.
Absolutely. I mean, you can even see it when Joan goes to look in on the friends from her hometown. It does look like that she's visiting some of the row houses that you might see in D.C. that are like packed really close together. It does kind of look like it might be that kind of street, even though it's just a really quick little image. I did like that setting there.
And Joanne is just – she's just now, these stories, we should say, are short. This is true for most of the Miss Victory stories. They're 5-6 pages, so there's not a lot of space to get in depth. But kind of an advantage to that is it just cuts through the crap, and you just have a very strong female superhero mm-hmm. who just, you know, always bravely goes in and just kicks butt, and it mm-hmm. – it's there occasionally, But these stories don't have some of the sexism that, because even in some of the superheroine stories in the 40s, no matter how strong or brave the Superman is, you still have some sexism show up in the stories and how they're treated, or even the secret identity dynamic. Mm-hmm. But I don't really see much of that in the Miss Victory stories. You know, in her civilian identity, she tends to be treated with respect. In her superheroine identity, she does as well. And she always mm-hmm. just mops the floor with the bad guys.
Literally.
Yeah, sorry. That was no pun intended on that.
But yeah, that's the thing, is that she has a job as a stenographer, is basically her full-time job, that she then does Miss Victory work on the side. But yeah, she's just, there's really no big romantic interest story in these issues. There's no male presence in terms of like a supporting cast member who's really persistent. They're just kind of like, they come and they go. But it's really her story all the time. They don't have any of that being forced in there. And she's a very capable person in both identities. And this earlier story is also one where she's not necessarily well known yet, or and the police don't trust her or know who she is, that recognize her as a superhero. But she just goes in, and you know, that's what's kind of sold me when you introduced the character in the first place to me on the Twitter post that I saw from you, is that, you know, here she is. She's basically a woman version of Captain America, just socking Nazis in the jaw. And
always a good thing.
Yeah, you just have to love that. And for those of you who don't know what the character looks like, I'll in broad strokes, is kind of a cross between Supergirl and Captain America. That's what it kind of looked, boiling it down, really. I'm not going to say this. It's not a knockoff on that, because of course Supergirl appeared much later than this. But she'll have a blue long sleeve shirt on, red shorts, sometimes a skirt, sometimes it's a blue shorts. It depends on the issue. You know, red gloves, red cape, and red boots with like white trim at the top. It's always kind of like changing during these issues in this early era, and even later I think that there's always like little changes happening. I don't really think that's a story choice. I imagine that's more just the artist is like that Charles Quinlan is just felt like drawing something different this issue. I think it's as simple as that. But so sometimes she has a star on her chest, sometimes it's just a V-neck shirt, and sometimes it's like in this issue, this story, there's a white capital V on her chest. Sometimes her cape is blue, sometimes it's red. It just waffles around. But it's also like, it's either an artistic choice, or if it was a character choice, it'd be like, well, she's not gonna dress the same every day. I don't know about that. But it's just fun to see the variations they give her look throughout these issues.
Golden Age comics were like that. They were always constantly kind of tweaking the costumes. And I do think in a lot of cases it wasn't necessarily intentional. Mm-hmm. It was just different artists, or it was just not necessarily quite remembering what they did mm-hmm. before. And she wasn't as bad as some. Her changes were a little more subtle or slow. And I think later she did do a bigger change, like you mentioned, the V-neck mm-hmm. and the short sleeves. But some are notorious, like the Whizzer from Timely Comics. He never settled. His costume was constantly changing. Other than being mostly yellow, it was never the same, like, issue to issue. Mm-hmm. Hers at least had some stability. There's sort of two bigger periods and little variations in between. Although, I do think what she was wearing in your story, mm-hmm. I like that look much better than what she's wearing in my story. My story, she did have the sort of V-neck with larger cleavage and the short sleeves on her arms, and yours was more of a, I don't know. I just, for some reason, I just liked the costume in your story where she had the longer sleeves, the gloves, the cape. Mm-hmm. It just had more of a kind of old school look, really. I don't know what to say beyond that, but I definitely like the costume in your story more.
Right. I completely agree. I mean, that's what attracted me to the character in the first place. I mean, she has long blonde hair going out there. It's like, so when you first showed it to me, it's like, wow, this character, just the character design just jumped out at me as like, that is a beautiful character design. I think that's what it really got down to, is that I just was immediately attracted to this character design. Now the later redesigns that for like the issue that you're going to cover, it's like, yes, they're going to being much more blatantly cheesecake sexy looking, and she's beautiful in these ones, but it's not overtly sexy. I mean, yes. We're seeing her legs, which is not too surprising. But really it's very much more of a modest cover, costume in general. But it still looks great. I also kind of think it's fun that her mask is also one of the things that she always wears a mask, especially in these early issues. And it's almost never the same color from issue to issue, but it was so funny that when I was looking at it, my modern reading was misinterpreting her white mask as being like wraparound visor.
Me too. I had the same thought the first couple times I read her before I realized, no, this is the 40s. This is supposed to be more like the domino mask type mm-hmm. thing that Robin has. But exactly. I had the same thing. I thought it was more like a visor, like a lab glasses type of look mm-hmm. to it.
Exactly, exactly. When it's drawn as white or yellow, my brain immediately was filling in to be a visor. In the issues when it's red or blue, it's like then it more blatantly looks like a mask. And it works that way. It's like now that I know that it's a mask, I look at it that way and I don't see it any other way. But I do remember very blatantly the first few times I saw it, it's like, wow, were they really trying to do a visor way back then? That's pretty interesting. It's like, no. it's just the lines drawn across her face with the color filled in. So it's just a mask.
No, I had exactly the same thought the first time I got exposed to her, too. You know, one thing you mentioned that I wanted to comment on is you talked mm-hmm. about how she wasn't that well known at this point, and this is kind of early in her career. Mm-hmm. The Golden Age comics didn't always have a lot of continuity.
Right.
But, you know, looking at our story tonight, now, obviously, I haven't gotten to mine yet, but, you know, her situation has very much changed between them. In this story, like you said, she's, you know, local. She's still become sort of a patriotic hero, but she's not that known. The police don't necessarily know what to think of her. By the time we get to my story, she's practically a government agent. She's,
yeah.
You know, her mm-hmm. identity is known to government. They're sending her on missions in Europe to fight, you know, Nazis. She's much more accepted. I'm sure if I read all of the issues, the segues wouldn't always be smooth and not the clearest evolution, but that's still a nice evolution for her character over time to see her go from being more vigilante type to suddenly crossing over, being accepted and virtually recruited into the government as an agent to go send off to Europe, and also to see her setting change and go from just mm-hmm. fighting, you know, saboteurs and such in DC to actually going overseas and just full blown fighting Nazis in the European theater.
Absolutely. I mean, it is kind of look into this little time capsule of the comics of the past. Like, yes, every single story is fighting Nazi saboteurs. I can't imagine there were actually that many Nazi saboteurs in the U.S. They're just that doesn't sound right. But they're nice, easy cannon fodder for stories for the superheroes to beat up. So I understand why they went that route. And it's like it's rah rah, buy war stamps, buy war bonds. You know that they were helping out with that whole effort that way. It's a simple formula, but it works. It works for what the character was about.
Yeah, it was refreshing to see them eventually move her away, though, and actually just say, no, we're just going to send her to Europe.
Yeah.
Because so many heroes like Superman and Batman, you know, they never really sent. They would go out of the way to kind of keep them local and fighting the saboteurs. Whereas mm-hmm. Timely and some of the other companies were like, no, we're just going to send them straight into the European theater. And it makes some mm-hmm. sense. I mean, you can see why Superman could end the war in a heartbeat, whereas Captain America, as powerful as he is, you could explain why he would actually be fighting Nazis for years, helping the war, but not necessarily be able to blink his eye and end it like Superman would. So certain mm-hmm. characters work better than others. And I think she, once we see with my story, she does work in that European theater as well. She may be a superhero, mm-hmm. but she's not going to just go straight into Berlin and grab Hitler in the way that Superman would.
Absolutely. I'll go switch gears a little bit and just compliment the artwork by Charles Quinlan on this issue. I was very, really impressed with how much detail work there is on the faces of his characters. I mean, the bad guys, there's actually a lot of detail that's like, yeah, these are bad guys. And he just makes Joan Wayne look, you know, as a very lovely woman throughout this. Again, without trying making her overtly sexual. But there's really, it's you know, the artwork really sold me on this. I mean, I looked at like some of the artwork in the other stories in the same issues, And honestly, a lot of them felt kind of, you know, tame or safe in terms of their storytelling.
Yeah.
But, you know, Quinlan really gets some dynamics in there. Like the panel where they knock out the, where both Joan and her friend Maggie knock out the one guy together. It's like, that's a pretty brutal little punch, little hit right there. She just slams the tray on top of his head. It's like, that's a really good panel. And then when we're seeing Miss Victory driving her car and jumping out of the car, it's like, that's a great pose. It's like, that's just dynamic and flowing. And you just have a lot to love there with that, with the artwork in this whole panel, this whole scene. That, and I also noted that was one of the things that he kind of liked to do, is that either Miss Victory herself or the people that she was fighting would often break out of the panel borders.
Yes.
Which I felt was that also helps it keep it lively. Other stories, even in the same issues, would be very much nothing happened outside the borders. The borders were definitely like the boundary of any artwork, and was just like almost editorially chopped off to not have anything happen outside it. But no, here's like Miss Victory's elbow will be kicking out over here, her boot will be kicking out off the side over here, and like when she's, and like on the last page where she swings the mop and the mop is crossing over the panel.
That was the panel I was going to talk about. That's my favorite.
Isn't that great? Isn't that great?
There's so much power behind her swing.
Mm-hmm.
You can really feel it. Like her body's moving in a way that's a woman who just put all of her strength behind this swing. She's kind of leaning over. The guy, you can tell he just got whacked hard, and he is flying down the steps. And like you mentioned, getting kind of off panel. Like you said, the end of the mop is extending over into the other panel next to it. So that, I made a note of that because that was my favorite panel of this issue for all the reasons you just said.
Oh yeah, that's just fantastic artwork right there. That whole last page has also just continues to have just as good dynamic stuff happening. Like when she tackles the one guy by diving between his legs, like that's just awesome.
And that's a really unusual panel. That's an angle you don't see. And you'd almost, if you described it to someone, you wouldn't think it would work. But here, it actually really works. It's because you just have a straight view of her diving forward. And you really, honestly, just see the guy's butt in the back of his legs as he goes down. But it's a very powerful panel, and it works really well.
Oh, yeah. But then what sells it is that we're seeing Miss Victory's face head on. So it's like we're seeing her view, her coming towards us, the reader, at the same time. So that's just great stuff. And now, of course, the panel that clinched me loving this particular story so much and wanting to read more of Miss Victory was the second to last panel, where she's escaping from the cops by sliding down the banister.
Yeah.
And what does she say? She says, "I can't stand questioning, so I'll see you in the next Captain Arrow comics."
Breaking the old fourth wall.
Oh, that was just fantastic. So I had to. That sold me right then and there that, okay, I want to read more of this character. That's just too much fun.
I do picture the cops afterwards going, "Damn it, we got to wait until next issue." There was a lot of that in the Golden Age where it was like in the last panel or two, they would break the fourth wall like that and talk to the audience. And for as dumb as it may sound to like modern readers, it works. It just makes you feel like, it just gives you kind of a warm, fuzzy, nostalgic feeling at all, you know, when you read it.
Exactly. I mean, we see that, and we'll see that in the other story too. And even that in the last panel of this story, it's like, it's those, they're not above those winks to the reader. They'll give that George Reeve wink. Right.
Exactly.
There.
That's a perfect comparison.
You know, it's like, that's what it draws us in. We're in on the gag. We're in on the fun. And the last thing, of course, is that we have not kind of talked about the elephant in the room about her name of Joan Wayne. So hopefully everybody knows that that's got to be a play on the name John Wayne. That's what I would presume it is, because he was a famous movie star by that point as well.
Yeah,
and I don't think he's he might not have done too many war movies yet by that point, but he still would have been a prominent enough star that makes perfect sense that would be the name that he that she came after. Although she's also, just a note, she's not related to Bruce Wayne as far as we know. That'd be a whole different kind of story going on.
That's only because Roy Thomas hasn't had Roy Thomas hasn't had the opportunity to write her yet, but if he ever did, I'm sure he would come up with a way to connect her.
Exactly. And I know that I read in one of the stories that they actually also did say that she was, that Joan is supposedly a descendant of Mad Anthony Wayne, which I had to look up because I'm terrible at
history. I don't remember that. Who is Mad Anthony?
He was like a Revolutionary War hero.
And he was a real guy.
He was a real guy.
Why did they call him Mad Anthony?
I think it was because, let's see, what did they say here? His military exploits and fiery personality earned him a promotion to Brigadier General pretty quickly. So, and it just be, obviously he's just a powerful personality and someone that nobody else got in the way of. So that it's a, I'm sure like most things, it made sense at the time.
That's awesome. I don't remember that. If I read that, I completely slipped my mind. But you know, not to get corny, but you know, when I was a kid, I learned a lot through comics. Like I actually learned a lot about history. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot about vocabulary, you know, when reading comics. And I like this idea that back in the 40s, kids learned stuff reading this. They may have learned who that dude was. They may have learned other stuff reading these comics, just like I did when I was reading them. Because, you know, as much as when I know it's changed now, because I've spoken to my daughter's librarian at school, that which has a wonderful graphic novel section, by the way. The view on it has changed tremendously. But when I was a kid, comics got so much crap from teachers and parents. But I learned so much through them. So I love any tidbits that's dropped in these old comics and thinking that, you know, despite all the crap they got in the 40s and 50s, that kids probably learned just as much as we did.
Absolutely. I know I sure did.
So now I will be covering the Miss Victory story from Captain Arrow Comics number 22, which is cover dated April 1945. This story opens with a lovely splash page image of Miss Victory on a cliff's edge. She's surrounded by a bunch of flying falcons, and she's punching a man wearing a pilot's uniform, apparently punching him right off the cliff. And the blurb to this one reads, "Another assignment for Miss Victory. Once more, our gallant girl flying takes to the skies for the cause of victory. Read all about her latest episode as she battles the devil with wings." Now, the actual story opens with Joanne Wayne flying her specially designed plane across the Atlantic to London at the request of Colonel Kingsley. When she arrives, he explains that this is by far the oddest assignment she could have been given. Despite the development of radio and other marvelous devices, carrier pigeons remain a vital intelligence arm to the fighting units in the field. He explains that during the past 30 days, not one pigeon has returned from their fighting lines. His plan is for her to take a run out to the scene of the action and try to do a little observing from a high altitude. They plan to release a number of birds at a given time in hopes that she can discover what is happening. The next day, Joanne is aboard a plane observing the pigeons when they suddenly come under attack from larger birds. It's something of a bird massacre akin to the turkey dropping episode of WKRP, but Joanne takes her plane to try to disrupt the attack. Another plane suddenly streaks from the clouds and attacks Joanne. Somehow, Joanne had time to change her clothes amid all this, so she's no longer dressed in a pilot's suit, but has donned her Miss Victory costume. The bullets from the two planes have stopped the bird attack, and the two pilots take their plane in for a landing. The two pilots confront each other, and the stranger identifies himself as Gardo, King of the Falcons. He's trained his falcons to be the dive bombers of all birddom. Sorry, that's that phrase. And they do not have any particular love for pigeons, particularly carrier pigeons. Gardo declares that there's been enough childish gibbering and tries to grab Joanne to take her back to his falcon castle deep in the forest, but she delivers a powerful victory punch that knocks him down. He both sets a falcon on her and tries to pull out his pistol, but she's too quick to him and knocks him out cold. She returns to London, and Colonel Kingsley tells her that it's wonderful how she accomplished so much in just a few hours. Their strafers and bombers have completely wiped out Greta's falcon aviary, and the menace is over thanks to Miss Victory. And of course, given the time period, the story ends with Miss Victory delivering the famous V for Victory sign with her fingers, and the narrator encouraging us to keep buying more and more war bonds and stamps. You know, I did like the follow-up at the end where he mentioned that the strafers and bombers have wiped out Greta's falcon aviary, because you don't always necessarily have that kind of detail in there, but it would make sense that he's still got that castle with all of his falcons that could be used. So they would have to follow it up. But those kind of thing, loose ends aren't always tied up in Golden Age comics. So I like that one.
That's nice. Yeah. That's a nice little button on the story.
So what'd you think of this one?
This one was pretty fun. It's a little wackier in the Golden Age style of wackiness, which you roll with it, but it's still kind of, I can't help but point some of the things out on it. Like our villain, he has the pilot aviator suit on, and on top of his headgear, he has that feather plumey thing, which I do recognize when they show it later, in that it's exactly the same as the mask that he has on one of the Falcons. You've seen it with trained birds and things like that, that they'll have that little plumey thing on top of it, which I presume helps to like give you a little bit additional thing to hold the mask with between your fingers. But it's on top of his own head. So that's definitely putting
it's a weird look.
It's a weird thing. Yeah. But it's,
I guess
still,
it's his flair.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, You've got to have your branding even back, you know, back then. They knew how to brand you and brand for the villains. That's all the way. And, you know, let's look at, just going back to the very beginning, even the colonel's office, and he's describing the problem. And we go over and see there's this enormous painting or picture of a carrier pigeon on his wall, a framed picture of a carrier pigeon on his wall. Does he just have that up there all the time? Does he always just, his office just always has a carrier pigeon on the wall? Well,
they are in vital it, part of the intelligence that the army uses at the time.
So. I guess so. Is he called Colonel Carrier Pigeon behind his back? I don't know. But it makes sense in the panel, but it's like from a story wise, like, why is he have this big poster in his office? And
I'm going to use that as my backstory for him now that he gets mocked behind his back.
But it's still just it's a interesting story about, you know, using, but not too, it's relatively clever, you know, just introducing that, yes, we still need carrier pigeons. And so the natural enemy of them would be trained falcons. That's a good story point, but have the designs of both the planes. We have Miss Victory's plane, and then we have our Falconer's plane. And it's like his looks like a falcon with just the Nazi symbol on the tail, and her plane looks like a V, which is doesn't look like a very realistic plane at the time.
No,
but it's still fun designs.
Yeah, it's an interesting. I like the design of him just because it was so unique, and I can't remember seeing. And yeah, not realistic at all, but it fits for the character, and I don't remember seeing anything like it in any other comics.
Yeah, I'm going to be failing on my own personal history there, is that for a few years that I'm a computer programmer by profession, and for about 6 years I worked for a computer game company, and one of our games was a World War II multiplayer fighting game, and you actually would be flying airplanes that were looked like and flew like the authentic planes in World War II. So it was really a flight simulator, but you actually flew against other opponents. Now, this was back in the late 90s, when the internet was still modems at 19.2 baud, and it was an impressive piece of technology that the people who found the company were able to do, to make these massive multiplayer games, and people were playing them over modems. But I'm just racking my brains about the plane designs all of a sudden and going like, no plane in World War II shaped like the V plane. but it works for her plane. It's just like, what else would you expect Miss Victory to be flying?
It is interesting, like we were saying earlier though, now not only has she moved over to being basically a government agent now against the Nazis, but she has her own plane. She's got this specially designed plane for her to get to and from there quickly and on these missions, which is a big step from what we saw in the last issue, where she was more of just a local vigilante and she was fighting for the country. But, you know, this is a whole nother level, and it's a little more closer to Wonder Woman. You know, you got to wonder that her having her own plane, what kind of Wonder Woman influence there was there as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's a very strong parallel. But yeah, they're making that same transition that you were talking about before, about getting Captain America over to the front lines. It's like they're doing the same thing here. They're still kind of also keeping it, as we saw with the other stories in this in this era for her that they're not necessarily making her a combat pilot. So she's still flying more like the Wax would, you know, so her missions are not necessarily intended to be combat missions because the women pilots just didn't do that back then. But they still could be flying into some dangerous things. So they don't back off on that. They still are giving her, you know, some important things. And like making her a pilot, that's a very progressive thing to do.
Yeah.
I was very impressed by that.
And I also wonder if that wasn't just a Wonder Woman influence, but just from the mere fact that this comic is Captain Arrow comics, like you indicated, mm-hmm. A-E-R-O, because there always was kind of a tendency that, you know, the titles on the, you know, Action Comics, Detective Comics, Captain Arrow comics, you know, they weren't very, if a character was popular enough, they'd be awarded their own title, usually quarterly with their name. But mm-hmm. these were mostly anthology comics and they tended to have a theme. And while they change frequently, given the flavor of the month, as far as what was sales, I do wonder if her being a regular feature in Captain Arrow comics, where almost all the covers were, you know, aerial battles, or at least for a long time, if that played into it, of giving her the plane just to fit her into that theme of the issue as well.
I bet you're absolutely right. That's a very natural progression of what they did with her as well.
Yeah. But they managed to do it without having it take over the story and her become, like you said, she's not a fighter pilot, mm-hmm. but it is an important part of her character now. And she does place her into danger. It's, you know, it's significant. Her, you know, she goes in to dive bomb the Falcons to try to protect the pigeons and then, you know, lands with the guy. So it's a significant and integral part of the story, but it's not necessary that she's just suddenly a fighter pilot either. So they managed to work it in kind of a fitting and appropriate way without too much altering the character either.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely.
One thing I wanted to mention is that we have a different artist in this issue. In your story, mm-hmm. it was, you know, Quinlan. In this one, it's a Golden Age artist named Nina Albright, a woman artist, which right. wasn't as common, mm-hmm. but they were far more present in the Golden Age than we tend to remember. And I've been trying on my Twitter, you know, to kind of promote that and kind of get out some of the lesser known female artists. And Nina mm-hmm. was one of them at one point. And her art style is different, but I think her strengths are in a little bit of a different area than Quinlan was. Quinlan, we talked about the dynamic battle scene or the fight scenes he had, and, you know, particularly mm-hmm. that panel of her whacking the guy here. This story didn't lend itself to having really fight scenes, so I couldn't really judge her artwork on that. But one mm-hmm. thing that did jump out to me is whenever she shows Joanne outside of costume, particularly in her pilot uniform and some of the things, Joanne mm-hmm. is very beautiful. She draws a really beautiful woman, and it stands out in those. And you see it sometimes when she's dressed as a Victory in the clothes, but all the trappings kind of distract from it and make it harder to zero in. But in a pilot uniform where you really see her face stand out, Nina draws just a really gorgeous woman.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if she was not doing romance comics, I would be very disappointed, because she draws some, you know, beautiful women, and her men also look very good. I think that would be the kind of the story at that time that would have really worked well for this.
Well, you're but right, because she
I could
did.
See her draw. I could see her drawing a Lois Lane comic at this period, though, too. Man, she would just make Lois look perfect in her reporter outfits, going out solving. Crimes and things was what she did back then.
And you're right. She did do a lot of romance comics. That was mm-hmm. an era. Now she did not, I've noticed for probably sexist reasons behind the scene, but I'm just inferring, but I've noticed a lot of Golden Age female artists did get kind of pigeonholed into romance comics mm-hmm. and she did a lot, but she didn't seem to be quite as pigeonholed as some of the others. She had a lot more variety. She still did adventure strips. She still did a lot of military strips, even war comics. Mm-hmm. Nice. So she seemed to have a broader, but I did get the sense, and this is just my inference, but I did get the sense that probably more than anything, she did end up drawing romance. She just also happened to have kind of a greater variety beyond that and be able to work, especially because Fiction House had quite a few female artists that they had hired, and they had Planet Comics and Jumbo Comics and a couple others that had a lot of different genres in them. And it gave mm-hmm. them, I think, a little more opportunity to work out for a lot of the female artists of the era to work outside of just the romance comic. Because also, we're mm-hmm. still a few years away from romance comics really becoming a thing. It wasn't until Simon and Kirby kind of got into it in the late 40s, that really became a thing.
Right.
And so mm-hmm. she's earlier in the year, so she's gotten a chance to kind of do a lot more variety than some of the others.
Well, but, I did really like her artwork overall. I think I preferred Charles Quinlan's style in especially in the fight scenes, mm-hmm. but it's still, you know, her depiction of the falcons flying in the swarm of them, the flock of them flying up to the planes, like, man, those are some good looking falcons, and there's a lot of detail on them, and there's a lot of them. My goodness, she worked hard to make all those feathers. That was a lot of work.
Yeah, she did not take the easy way out. Some of these mm-hmm. panels have a lot of them.
Yeah, that's some great attention to detail right there.
That's a George Perez approach to doing it. You know, why do 6 if you can throw 15 in?
Oh, yeah. And you see that even on like the last page when you get the close-up on one of the falcons and how many feathers she put on that falcon's back and tail. It's like, oh, my gosh, that's gorgeous. And that would be so hard. But then she throws her – we see the victory punch thrown. That's kind of like the big action moments really in this issue. And those are pretty good. Those are pretty good. But they're still kind of like a one-punch movement right there. But like, man, it's also – she's pretty hardcore that she punches out the falcon to then hit the knockout the bad guy. It's like, oh, my gosh. That's pretty extreme.
No, well, that's one of the great things about the Ms. Victory comics is there's no – I mean, you could substitute a male superhero and not mm-hmm. bat an eye, and which is how it kind of should be. I mean, this is not –
yeah, that's true.
You know, so many of the comics in the era, like I said, even with the female superheroes who were lead, you know, the title characters, they still had a fair amount of sexism injected in the stories, where with her, mm-hmm. she's just a government agent. They call her for a special mission. She goes in and she just kicks ass, and no one, even the bad guys, don't treat her as really different or talk down to her. They just respect her, and she just gets the mm-hmm. job done. And yeah, she will punch that falcon if she needs to do it.
That's right.
Although this costume is a little more, you know, we mentioned earlier that mm-hmm. the costume you had, I much prefer. Although you mentioned the visor. The whole looking here, mm-hmm. this very much looks like a visor to me in this story. It does not look like a mask. And I think it's, like you said, the coloring of it.
Right.
That's where that comes from.
Well, it's some of the panels, it also looks more like a mask than on others, since it looks like it might hug a little too. It obviously looks like it's just part of the drawing. So that definitely makes it feel like more of a mask. But yeah, it's also just so big in some panels, too. It's like, wow, is that supposed to be a visor again? It's like the brain just filling in the blanks there. It just keeps happening. But yeah, this costume is a bit more cheesecake than the other one.
Bit. She basically is, the V-neck goes down to her belly button.
Yes.
Basically. And she has no sleeves at all. It's basically a bra that kind of covers the side of her, you know, stomach, really. And that's all it is.
It's the moon dragon.
It's the moon dragon costume. Perfect. Exactly. Yeah. Thank you.
The only distinctions being, of course, the color schemes, like the red, the blue top and the red cape. She does have a V clasp for her cape, which is pretty cool. But then red shorts, which are a bit more modest than what Moondragon would wear. And instead of I shouldn't be too hung up on it, but boy, I preferred the lace-up boots that the original look had versus the Cavalier style boots that are here. I mean, they are a superhero standard, the Cavalier boots, but there's something about the look, about having the more practical looking boots that she actually had to lace up in the front. And the artist went going to the trouble of drawing those laces that just made it, you know, I felt more, it gave it kind of not a bad gritty, but you know, that kind of gritty feel to it. It's like, yeah, this is a real costume. Something would really wear.
Yeah, it's the difference between Batman's kind of pouches utility mm-hmm. belt versus just the little old style, little oval things going around him. It's one's more realistic.
Right. Exactly.
It reminds, you mentioned the Moondragon, which is a perfect analogy, but it also reminds me of, do you remember in the early 70s when they would let kids draw their own Supergirl costumes and they would use them in the stories. So Supergirl's costume was changing like every, and some of them were just weird. And some of them, and not necessarily exposing weird like this one, but some would cover it completely, but others would look like, you know, a stripper's costume. It was just all over the map. This kind of makes me feel like when I see it, and you already mentioned that the color scheme with Supergirl is not that different to begin with, even though this character came far earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But I view like what you read as her classic costume, whereas I look at this and I feel like what I felt when I would read those weird early 70s stories where mm-hmm. Supergirl's costume was just all over the map. It's fine. It's not terrible, but it's just this is not the classic Miss Victory to me. When I think of classic Miss Victory, I think of what you read. And this is just, you know, not only what you said about the boots, but the whole design just doesn't mm-hmm. feel right to me for some reason.
Yeah, it's also reminiscent of like those other designs for Phantom Lady's costume. There's and the more perhaps more like the modern interpretation of what classic Phantom Lady's costume looks like, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
It's like we have to show much more cleavage than the originals actually showed sometimes.
But headlight costume.
Yeah. Definitely a lot of that going on there too.
I also missed the long hair. Her hair's a lot
shorter.
Yeah,
her hair's now shorter here. Yeah.
For some reason, just in the fights, the way Quinlan would draw them, it's just something about the long hair just kind of worked. He worked it into the art, whereas here, mm-hmm. being shorter, it just doesn't, I don't know, it just doesn't work for me as well for some reason.
Right. Now, I feel the same way, but that being said, it's still, you know, extremely good artwork.
Oh yeah, it's great. Especially
she has such great attention to detail, and makes her a beautiful woman along the way. So,
I would like to have seen Nina draw the original costume because I think she could really do it justice. You know, because
mm-hmm.
she does draw the character so beautifully. Even though we're not particularly fond of this look, she does the most she could do with it, and she really does draw the way she draws her face and her body, and the, you know, particularly in the pilot suit. Even just seeing all we see there is her face, and it's just so beautifully drawn. I would have loved to have seen her done the original look.
Oh, yeah. That would have been a real treat. And that's one thing, it's kind of hard to tell if this costume change was the writer's decision, the artist's decision, an editorial decision. It's hard to know for sure where the motivation came from.
Yeah, this is totally a guess. I have no knowledge. Ultimately, I would probably go with editorial just because I already mentioned how a lot of costumes would change a lot over the Golden Age and it would be very inconsistent. But for the most part, it was details. It was like, you know, this person would have a belt this issue. They wouldn't. They would be mm-hmm. have long pants this issue. They wouldn't. They would have some short sleeve this issue, then long sleeve. But this is a much more drastic change. This is a complete mm-hmm. reworking of her costume. This is a conscious. This isn't just an artist saying, oh, I don't. How did I draw? I can't remember. Oh, it's probably this. This is a very conscious decision to completely change the look of the character. So mm-hmm. it's possible she came up with it, but clearly editorial would have been involved with this choice. And I feel like this is something that came from a meeting where they were like, well, let's try something new or something. Or at least she had to run it by them. But this is not the situation where someone just can't remember what they drew. This is a mm-hmm. very conscious choice to completely change her look.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about that, because this new look is actually fairly consistent from this point on too. It doesn't vary much at all. The original costume and Charles Quinlan's artwork, it was changing almost every story. So he was definitely tweaking it and refining it there. But here there's like this one look kind of like settled, and it's like, it's pretty solid, like this. That, like, even the mask doesn't change color too much. Yeah. It's like, so I think it gets into a red phase when it's a red for a few stories in a row, but it's also white for a few stories in a row. I just wasn't sure if it was Nina Albright's idea, like that she, and you know, versus the writer's idea, which kind of is it just it's kind of a different motivation than behind it. It's like, is it, you know, that she really wanted to make her empowered by giving her a sexier costume, or was it more that, no, it'll sell better if we for the boys, the teens in our audience, or even just thinking about instead of saying teens, more like, you know, the young enlisted men that were probably a very important part of the audience back then.
Certainly.
And Miss Victory and Captain Arrow as a war title, that's a market to go towards. So I just don't know.
Yeah, when you mentioned Phantom Lady, that was a good comparison because it is a very similar design to her. Mm-hmm. And that's definitely, they're going for the cheesecake with that for sure.
Yeah.
But it was a solid story though. And it was another shorter mm-hmm. one, another six pager, which most of hers are. But like I said, I think that cuts through the fluff and you just get, a really short. It's also lends itself that, sometimes when you read stories really all the way from the 40s up to the 60s, they can be kind of repetitive because they weren't meant to be read in collections or trades. They were meant to be read every month. You'd read it and then you'd go away and you'd come back to the next issue. And, they could be sometimes repetitive. But the shorter nature of these stories, I found more than a lot of other Golden Age characters when I went back and read her. I was able to fly through a lot of issues just because, they are shorter. It doesn't take that long. And mm-hmm. so it was, I think if you are having any interest in the character for anyone listening, I think you'd really find her entertaining. And I think you'd actually have a pretty easy road of going through a lot of her, pretty much her whole run without having to take a lot of effort because it's just not that long. I mean, her mm-hmm. run's fairly long, but the issues themselves are not.
Yeah. In fact, I cheated myself when I was getting ready for the show here in that the Digital Comics Museum had one issue available that was, was a reprint issue by the AC Comics group that pulled together just her stories from these various issues. So you could just fly through just the Miss Victory parts and not have the rest of the Captain Arrow stories. Now, I don't mind going back and looking at the other ones at some point, just because I'm curious about what they did with them. Especially the Catman character. Catman himself is like, Catwoman is such a well-known character. It's like there's just the curiosity's sake of like, is there any impression or any similarities at all there? Is something, of course, as a comic book nerd, I have to know.
And he doesn't have a look that's that different than DC's later Catman. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's pretty wild.
I mean, they're not related in any way. It just mm-hmm. happens to be that his look isn't that different.
But yeah, if you just want to read, if you just want to get the feel for Miss Victory's original stories, it's like you can get this one download and they're all in it. It's really a breezy but fun read. And yeah, it will feel repetitive in the fact that yes, it's going to be the same bad guys, but lots of Golden Age stories were like that. They, as you said, they weren't meant to be, they weren't expecting that you would care. Oh,
yeah. It would blow the minds of these creators to know that we'd be talking about this 80 years later.
Absolutely.
First, they'd want to know what the hell is a podcast, but once we explain it, it would blow their mind.
And I also, and now I can't, it's also kind of surprising to me that I remember when Femme Force came back out back in the day. I never bought a single issue of it. I was never tempted to buy any of the issues of it, but I remember when those came out. And now all of a sudden it's like, maybe I should try to find some Femme Force in the 50-cent bins at the comic book stores. Oh man.
Yeah, I
never thought honest, I'd say I, that.
I've never read them either, so I really have no, it wasn't just the sort of thing that jumped out to me either, but I am kind of curious now just to see. I did see a reference that apparently at some point Miss Victory took another version of that formula that apparently turned her evil for a while and she became a bad guy. And I can't remember what her name was.
Oh, man.
But then she was cured and became a hero again. Mm-hmm. And then she had a daughter who took that formula. But instead of turning her into a bad guy, she just became more of an anti-hero who still was – I don't know if she was part of Femme Force or I don't know enough about it, but apparently she was still, a good guy, just more in the vein of an anti-hero. So there's some legacy to that character, but this is just based on literally a quick Wikipedia type entry. I've never actually read the stories.
Right.
So any final thoughts about this issue or your issue or Miss Victory?
I don't think so.
Me neither. I think it has been a lot of fun, though, Tim. I really appreciate your coming on to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. And and for introducing me to this character. It's always great to find something new to obsess over and feel the need to get every last reference to.
I do have to ask you, where can people find you online? I know you've been on some other podcasts and you're on Twitter. Can you tell people about those?
Sure. The best place to find me is on Twitter at TimPrice17, where you'll find plenty of my geeky adventures happening. I'm now the regular co-host on the Batgirl Cassandra Cain podcast that's on the Right On Network with Astrid Wright. I've been on it for just over 10 issues now, so that's been a lot of fun to explore that character's original run. I've had a few other podcast appearances lately. I've been on Cheers Cast for the season 2 a couple of times with Ryan Daly. I've enjoyed that quite a bit. And on Halloween, so this latest crossover podcast event came out. In 2018, I supplied the voice for Mephisto in the Mephisto versus the Podcasters crossover. And these podcasters were foolish enough to ask me to come back to do Mephisto's voice again for their Mephisto versus the Podcasters 2 Electric Boogaloo. That's not really the official title, where they're actually covering, each podcast is covering an issue from the Sandman volume called Dream Country. I did the voice for that as well. And that's the podcasts there are Unpacking the Power of Power Pack, the Adam Warlock Resurrections and Adam Warlock Thanos podcast, Married with Comics podcast, and the Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, otherwise known as the Squadron Supreme podcast. But whichever way you listen to it, it's a great show.
I love that show, by the way.
Oh, it's been so good.
The Squadron Supreme is, I love that series, and when they announced they were doing it, I was so excited.
Oh yeah, the show has been great, and it's been so awesome to revisit the series. Even though it's troubling from the modern viewpoint, it's been so much fun to talk about it and hear them discuss it again. So yeah, that's been a lot of fun with those guys. There's talk of a wrap-up episode to get us everybody together to talk about the series of Dream Country. So we'll see when that happens. But that's where you can find me nowadays.
Now, I will point out for the audience that this is the man, a little earlier in the episode, didn't think he could really be called a podcaster.
No, I don't think I can. I don't see that how that works.
I kind of think you can. But, you know, I don't want to start anything. But
If I make all of you guys look good or sound good, then I've done my job.
Well, that's why I had you here, because I really need someone to make me sound good. So thank you very much. But in all seriousness, Tim, thank you very much again. I really appreciate it. I do want to mention, just for the audience, obviously Chris isn't here again. So I just wanted to comment on that. As I mentioned, he's got a lot going on. So right now I'm having some guests on. We're building up to Chris coming back. I don't know where in the timeline this is going to fall, which I mean is I've recorded with someone else. I'm recording with a few more people after Tim. I don't know which one's going to air first or what order they're going to be in. It really is just going to come down on what's easiest to edit, probably more than anything. So this may very well be the first time with the guest star in this run. It may be somewhere else in the line, but I, again, really appreciate having Tim here. But at the end of the day, hopefully Chris will be joining me again and we'll get the show back on track after that. But in the meantime, I've enjoyed having the guests on and hearing some other voices, and I really appreciate everyone coming. So with that, I am going to say goodnight. Thank you for joining me.
We'll be dancing the victory polka, and we will give a mile.